Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spiders. So this episode will be a three-parter. These are always the ones that are super fun to try to title. I think that's the hardest part about doing the podcast is getting it done, where sometimes like I'm talking about some business that's happened in my room. Sometimes I talk about something that an incident might have happened. Then I get into the main topic. And then I get to the point where I have to post these and come up with titles for them. And it drives me nuts because I'm always afraid I'm going to put something up because every once in a while, the main part of the podcast doesn't start till several minutes in because I get my little spiel out of the way, we get warmed up. And I've had people before go, yeah, I read the title and it really didn't have anything to do with it. Well, it did. It just took me a while to get there. So I'm always very cognizant about that. And when I put together these episodes that have more than one question, it's always like, all right, which question do we put in the title or which topic do we put in the title? Do we put all three of them in the title? Do we put one in the title and then list them all in the bottom? So feel free to chime in if you ever had an issue with this. It's one of those tricky things because you want people to be able to find the information. And I will tell you, I've messed myself up with these before where I know I've done a podcast about a certain topic, but unfortunately I didn't put that topic in the title. And then I go back and search and I'm like, oh, I've never covered this before. And I cover it again because I didn't realize I'd done it. So always fun trying to figure out an appropriate title for it. So this one will have two of them were they've popped up quite a bit lately. And one of them, two of them were comments that really got me thinking. I love when every once in a while somebody hits you with a question that you stop and you pause and you go, wait a minute, how do I go about explaining? Like, I need to think about this for a minute. And not just because it's difficult, but because it makes you reconsider how you do things. I love those kind of questions. And I think those are the kind of questions that keep me evolving as a keeper, because sometimes you get one that's hit you in such a profound way that it makes you change what you're doing. And other times it's just you start thinking more about it. Like, how would I do this differently? Or how do I explain that this is supposedly the rule, but here I am violating it freely on my videos? It's a tough one. So we have a couple of those, and then we have one that came up. It's popped up a few times over the last several months, and again, I never know if sometimes what happens is somebody, one of the bigger YouTubers or something, does a video, and they say something in it, and people take it to heart, and then all of a sudden, I'm getting all these comments about, hey, this is bad to do. Like, for example, the crickets. I'm pretty positive one of the big pet tubers out there had issues with crickets, determined that the crickets were contaminated, were killing his spiders, and then all these people stopped using crickets and would come onto my videos and go, why are you using crickets? Don't you know those kill your spiders? It was just annoying. Just for lack of a better term, there was no like explanation for it. Just so I've had to do that one, and I've had other things pop up. But this one we're going to cover today has popped up quite a bit, and I do have some input on it, and I do want to kind of give my two cents on it. So to kick this one off, we'll start with something simple. I had a video up. And I apologize if you're out there listening, please feel free to email me or leave another message with your name. I thought usually what happens if I get a good comment that I want to discuss in a podcast, I'll take a picture of it on my phone so I have it so I can go, hey, blah, blah, I said this. And I thought I did for this one and I can't find it. So I'm guessing what I probably did is jotted it down in my notebook. I have a notebook that I keep podcast ideas in. You know, I write down notes if I'm going to do a video, whatnot. And I just went through it twice and cannot find this person's name. So I apologize in advance. Because I really wanted to mention your name because it was a great comment and it got me thinking. But basically what the comment was is talking about the virtues of using multiple hides, not just giving the spider one hide. And I immediately thought, yes, that's awesome. And then immediately stopped and went, why don't I do that more often? Because I have done it before. I have used multiple hides before. And especially for ones like burrowing species and stuff, I give them kind of a choice. Or in a case of, say, I believe my Orphanacus Pinnae blue, I had people come on and go, they're arboreal, semi-arboreal. I had other ones come on and go, they're fossorial. In my experience, they've been fossorial, but I didn't want to exclude the ability for them to get off the ground if that's how they want to hang out. So I kind of set up one with multiple hides. I did the same thing with a couple other spiders. Usually it's the ones that are semi, quote unquote, semi-arboreal, the ones that sometimes like to go a little bit off the ground on stuff. I will give them multiple hides, but that's about it. And I have in the past, like scorpions, sadly, I will always give multiple hides too, usually because with some species of scorpions, I am keeping part of it warm, one end warm, and I want to give them a way to get away from the warmth if it gets too warm. Back when I kept reptiles and when I kept snakes, I would give them multiple hides, one on each side, one on the cool side, one on the side that had the heating element, whatever it may be. And I think when we got the spiders, they don't need that. They don't need that heat on one side, no heat on another. So our thoughts are we set up an enclosure, and I've done a million, obviously, not a million, but a lot of rehousing videos, and then I always talk about what I'm putting them into. And usually it's the standard, you got one piece of cork bark, whether it be for an arboreal or a fuss or a terrestrial, you've got your substrate, hopefully you give them multiple, you know, several inches so that they can burrow if they want, you know, maybe put the moss is always in there, water dish, some plastic foliage on some of them. And that's about it. And I started thinking, why don't we do that more often? And I think it is a good practice and something that a lot of it would, even last week, I had a lot of people that contacted me with, hey, I set up my whatever name of species, and they don't seem to be settled in right now. And you get a picture of it, and it's your typical setup where it's got one hide. It's got maybe a little piece of plant in there, a lot of open space, a water dish, whatever, and the spider is in a stress pose in a corner by the water dish. Or the spider is in a stress pose, not underneath the cork bark, but behind the cork bark, you know, underneath that one little teeny plant they got there. And people are freaking out because they're not settling in quickly. There are many perks to offering multiple places for the spider to eventually settle in. And I will go a step further. I've had people show me where they've used multiple hides before and the spider has started off in one hide, got out of that hide after a little while, went to the other hide and set up shop there. So I do think that's a good technique and something I'm going to try to be a little more cognizant of. Now, why don't we do it? A, I think aesthetically, we're just used to seeing, like anybody that's, like I said, watching my videos, I set mine up almost the exact same way every time. I noticed it the other day, Billy and I were putting one together, that when I set them up, I almost always put the hide and the deeper end of the substrate to the right, or what'll end up being the back of the enclosure when it's on a shelf. The front of the enclosure, I put a water dish, a little moss. I do the same thing every single time. So anyone that's emulating me, they're starting in the hobby, they're looking for positive examples of how to set these guys up, and they're like, oh, here's this guy, seems to know what he's doing. They're going to end up setting theirs up the same way. That's not the be-all, end-all, and honestly, there is nothing wrong. I've done setups before in the past where I wasn't sure what was going to settle in. I did more experimentation, sadly, earlier on, where, for example, I believe it was at the time, H. lividus, that I was trying to figure out. I wanted it to burrow more quickly, and I had had trouble because I had been reading stuff that said that if you have a fossorial species, there's no need giving it a burrow. It'll make its own. So I'm like, all right, it's great. I'll drop this thing in a bin of dirt, and it'll do its thing. And unfortunately, as anybody that has kept fossorial species know, yes, eventually it'll probably make its burrow, but unfortunately, it's going to be scared to death for a little while and stressed out and won't start digging right away. So you'd get a lot of people, and I get a lot of folks still that will contact me with these fossorials. The Coelobrachia species comes up quite a bit. You name a fossorial species, P. muticus. Hey, I just picked up my P. muticus. I dropped it in this little tub of dirt. It's just sitting there. You need to give them starter burrows. And if you're smart, you give them starter burrows with a piece of cork bark over the top. So they immediately have a place they can bolt into. It's tight, it's secure, it's dark. They can feel comfortable and they'll start burrowing from there. What's even better than giving them one burrow, one choice, giving them multiple choices. And again, I did it with my C. lividus. Did I say H. lividus before? If I said H. lividus, it was the old name. Anyway, I did it with that, and that thing settled in immediately, and it was one of the ones that at one point I came out, I found her out in the open after she'd been settled in for a year or so. She moved over to the other burrow and started burrowing there. So I do think there is a lot of merit in giving these guys multiple places where to go. Stacking up cork bark. I've done that before with certain species where I had a couple extra pieces of cork bark that I really wasn't doing anything with. So I kind of made something where they could pick any from multiple nooks and crannies in these little stack of cork bark to find a hide in. Putting one on either side, you know, obviously we don't need to do it for the heat like we would for snakes or for scorpions, but there's nothing wrong with giving them some burrow choices on either side of the tank and then giving them maybe the water dish in the middle of the tank. I think we could be more creative with this. Now, why aren't we? Well, I think anybody that has spent money on trying to buy the fixings for these, whether it be cork bark, whether it be plastic plants, whether it be resin hides, whatever you're buying, this stuff can be expensive. And I know when I go and select cork bark, I have a big box of cork bark in my garage. I end up buying it in bulk and I'll get like, I think last time I got 15 pounds of it, 10, 15 pounds, big box, all different stuff. that stuff goes quickly for me. I have a lot of spiders. I'm doing a lot of rehousings. Yes, you can reuse it, but I have a terrible habit of pulling out the cork bark that's covered in web, that's covered in dirt, that's covered in feces, and just throwing it in a bin, going, I'll clean this out later, and never cleaning out. So I literally have like three bins full of old webbed up, pooed on cork bark in there that I haven't touched yet. If I clean those up, obviously I can use those. But what ends up happening is you go in there, you're setting up your enclosure, you notice you have five pieces of cork bark left, you know it costs a great deal of money, and you're like, I'm not going to waste it, I'm just going to use one piece. It's the easier, it works, it's the bare minimum, it works. But why not break that piece in half and use it on two different sides? There's definite things you can do. So I do think part of it is just because how much it costs. And speaking for myself, I actually, like I said, I have a lot of cork bark around here because I'm always buying it. I've always got the old stuff. I've always got something on hand. But that's because I've been doing this for years and years and years and years, and I buy it in wholesale. It's difficult for folks who just have a handful that maybe, you know what, they've got to do rehousing. It's a young adult now, they've got to put it into a bigger tank, and they're looking around, they're like, oh, I need to get some cork bark. They're not going to go out and necessarily buy it in bulk. So what ends up happening? You go to the local pet store, and you pay up the wazoo for it there, you know, 10 bucks for a little medium-sized one, or 12 bucks for a medium-sized one. You hop on Amazon, it's always good for, you know, like if you need some last-minute cork bark, you ship today, you can buy it there. But again, it's costly. So you don't want to spend all that extra money on it, so you only buy one, which I completely understand, because I think that's one of the reasons why I haven't gone and given a lot of my spiders multiple burrows, multiple hides. But I think moving ahead, we're going to do some experimenting with this to just kind of show people that you can do it. So I do think the money is part of it. I think the availability is part of it. There have been times where I've run out of my boxes of bulk, and I have something I have to rehouse, and I'm scrambling. And I go over to, I remember one time at Amazon, I needed a big cork bark round. I ended up paying 25 bucks, and then they sent me this tiny little, like it wasn't nearly as big as I needed. So I do think money is a factor, but again, they're not that expensive to keep in the first place, so there's nothing wrong with people buying multiple pieces, having them on hand, spending a little extra money on the fixings as opposed to the spiders, because I know the idea of this hobby is save as much money as you can for the spiders because you're going to be buying a lot of them. I think a lot of us get in that mindset of, at least at first, I'm not going to spend a lot of money on housing because if I drop $100 on a fancy acrylic home, then that's enough money to buy two slings from a species that I've been admiring. It's tough. It's a juggling act. But I do think moving ahead, I am going to experiment more with this because I do think it would help more people out that see this and go, all right, maybe I'll give them multiple hides, because I do find that times that I have used it, they do seem to settle down more quickly. Now, to piggyback on this a little bit, the other thing we kind of skimp on is the foliage, the cover, the stuff that's going to allow your spider to hide and feel comfortable, especially if it's an arboreal species. I am guilty of this because I have the darndest time trying to find good fake plants. Some of them I use the real plants in. I have a lot of golden pothos in my enclosures, which I think once they bloom, it really helps kind of fill in some of the space, as long as I don't accidentally kill them, which happens every once in a while. But the plastic plants are great for some of those arboreal enclosures and even with some terrestrials. I mean, some of the terrestrial species, if you give them some stuff where they feel like they can hide, they will come out of their burrows more. They will be more visible. Now, I have species that don't seem to care if they have hides once they get to adulthood, that really don't care if there's plastic plants. So there's no need really, unless you're setting up an aesthetically pleasing enclosure, to worry about it as much. So for example, my Formictopus species, once they get to be adults, they just sit right out in the open. They don't care. The only ones I believe that sometimes hide underneath their cork bark are my Atachromatis. The rest of them right out in the open at all times. So not as big of a deal. But if you have other spiders, I know my Theraphosa species will continue to burrow a bit right through adulthood. I know that if you have some plants out, like the other day, I caught mine hiding behind her pothos. I had my Theraphosa blondii was out and she was hiding behind her water dish and pothos. Extra foliage gives them cover, again, makes them more secure. In the wild, a lot of these guys don't live in just barren landscapes. They're going to come out, there's going to be bushes, grass, foliage, whatever, that's going to provide them some cover. We should give them more cover. So again, I try to put plastic plants in with my arboreals to make sure they have cover. That really helps. I can't tell you how many times I get pictures of, hey, I just bought a Vicularia or Carabina versicolor, a juvenile, adult, whatever, and it's just scrunched up in the corner of its enclosure. It's not using the hides. And then you look in and there's like a piece of cork bark one little branch and the whole rest of the enclosure is wide open. There's no cover for it. That's not going to work. I used to like the trick, like pokey sometimes, I would put the plastic plant in and I would lean the cork bark against kind of the plant. So it was, the plant was half under the cork bark, which gave it some place to hide in there. Then I would fill the other side with some moss. So right away, it's got a place it can hide. So adding those extra plants, adding extra hides, I'm going to make a concerted effort when I'm done with this podcast. I'm actually going to go order some more cork bark, see if I can find some more fake plants and stuff. Try to do more of this moving ahead with some of my spiders to give people a different look. Because again, it was one of those comments that it was like I immediately agreed with wholeheartedly. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Why don't I do this? And when I thought about it, it came down to, I think, old habits. Like now I do have the materials to do this. And I do always, I will say, with my setups, with my rehousings, I try to show everybody the easiest way to do things. A lot of times, the most inexpensive way to do things. We're not going to the moon here. Obviously, we could do a lot more fancy setups, but the idea is like this is a solid setup for your spider. We don't want to go crazy at first, because I have seen pictures of enclosures where people, in my opinion, have overdone it with the decorations, have overdone it with the hides. It ends up being just this very busy. I mean, again, I guess the spider may be okay with it because there's really no open area for it. But I do think there's a fine line between giving them a lot of different places to hide and go behind different hides, different foliage, blind spots where they can feel secure, and going overboard to the point where the spider is just crowded by all the stuff that's in his aquarium, which if it's an arboreal species, it's going to get pooed all over anyway. But there is absolutely nothing wrong with just not doing the one hide, one plant, one water dish. I've done multiple water dishes. Definitely feel free to experiment, come up with different ways to set them up, stack it. I like the old trick. I've done this before, and I think I'll try this again. A lot of times you get the cutoff pieces of the cork bark that are too small to really for them to hide underneath, but they're good for if you want to construct kind of like, for lack of a better term, a honeycomb of burrows. So I like to build, basically use bigger pieces, smaller pieces in between to make a bunch of little spots they can go in and then cover that whole thing with dirt. And I've had some luck with that. So we'll do some more of that in the future and post videos up of that. So just give people something else to think about. Because again, it's all about making the spider feel as safe and secure as quickly as possible, and giving them alternatives is definitely the way to go. More prudent than just giving them one spot and then sitting there looking at the poor spider in the corner that's not the corner we expect them to be in, all scrunched up and opposed, going, what's wrong with it? Well, it just didn't cotton to the thing that you set up for it. However, had you given it a couple more or more alternatives, it may have settled in more quickly. So excellent, excellent, excellent comment. Again, really got me thinking. Now I'm at the point where I'm looking around the room and I'm like trying to figure out who I have to rehouse next. Now, we'll see how it goes. I have a couple big ones I have to rehouse, and I'm putting in the Sterilite containers. There's only so much room in the Sterilite containers. I do use those for my larger terrestrial species, but I have some other things I have to set up soon. Like I have to set up a T apothecis that I may do the multiple hides thing. We'll see if we can get some plastic plants. If anybody knows a good spot to get plastic plants, I used to get some for Petco that I used in a lot. They were like $7. They were good size. They were great for arboreals. And last few times I went to order from them, they didn't have them. So please feel free to shoot me an email or drop a link. So if you don't want to give up your sources, I know how it stinks. I can't tell you how many times I said, hey, these are really great. And I go to buy them and they're gone. It's like, thanks, everybody. I'm just kidding. But seriously, plastic plants, big one. And let me know, because that's something I'm definitely going to be needing more of in the future. So while on the topic of enclosures and setups, and as I'm saying this, I realize all three of these questions can be intertwined because they're all about setups and enclosures. I had another comment. I posted up a video, I believe this featured my Valhalla, and I also in the beginning of the video tried out these new cages that are, if I'm being honest, I bought them because they're called Crapels, C-R-A-P-E-L-L-E-S, Crapellus, Crapels. Just the idea that it had the word crap in it made me giggle probably way more than it should have. So I'm like, I'm going to give these a try, because again, I do like buying stuff off Amazon, trying it out and letting people know, hey, I think this could be worth it. I think it's definitely worth it. Not worth it to me, but mileage may vary, whatever it may be. So I used this Crapels setup, what I thought was a good looking enclosure. We had a nice cork bark round for it. Of course, it didn't use the round. It went behind it, but lots of substrate, some moss, looked really good. And then I had somebody come on and say, you know, that looks really good, but what about cross ventilation? Don't they all need to have cross ventilation? And somebody else came on and said something along, yes, they all absolutely need cross ventilation. And then I noticed the same person, another thing, asked about cross ventilation. She said, that's all she's read about. They need cross ventilation. They need cross ventilation. But she said, as I've been going around YouTube and watching other videos and watching how people keep them, I see there's a lot of enclosures out there that don't offer cross ventilation that people use. And again, it got me thinking, and it was one of those deals where it's like, it was too much to articulate in a response. I did respond and I tried to quickly explain myself, but it got me thinking, like, I know obviously the be all end all when we talk about setting up tarantulas, got to have good cross ventilation. A lot of this comes from the Avicularia species, Avicularia carabina versicolor. They're species that we have found that do much, 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 much better when there's a lot of airflow. You don't want any stagnant air in there. You want to make sure that there's air going through that enclosure, getting through, cleaning everything out, keeping the air circulating. And that's awesome. And for years, we have read that cross ventilation is ideal. And it is. I'm not going to, please, let me just make sure it's very clear that whatever I'm about to say, I'm not trying to say good cross ventilation isn't ideal. It absolutely is. However, I do think that there are cages out there that don't necessarily offer the cross ventilation that we would like to see, that we have all used successfully for many, many years. For a long time, I didn't use some of these because they didn't offer cross ventilation, and I saw more and more keepers that I respected that were breeding them, that were doing well with them, using them. So let's take a moment and talk about where did the idea of cross ventilation come from. And I think to do that, we want to go back in the day, in the 80s, in the 90s. And I was not keeping in the 80s, just to be clear. I got my first in the 90s. But back in the day, there were no real tarantula enclosures. And quite frankly, limited enclosures for exotics in general. So if somebody went to a pet show and bought a lizard, a tarantula, a frog, guess what it got put into? Let's see who can get this one. Pop quiz. What did you put your pet into in the 90s when you picked it up? Well, if you said the almighty 10-gallon aquarium with mesh top, you are absolutely right. Those reigned supreme back in the day. Everything, those were the... Now, granted, they are usually called aquariums or fish tanks. They're meant to keep fish in. They're meant to keep, you know, water in. But a lot of folks found that they made good enclosures for whatever pet they may bring home. I've seen hamsters set up in these things back in the day. I had seen gerbils set up in these things back in the day. All you need, some company decided, hey, all we need to do is make some mesh tops for them. You place them over the top. They had those little hooks you put on the side, and we're good to go. So a lot of folks would use those. And where was the ventilation? The ventilation was on the top. So we're not going to get into why they are not appropriate for tarantulas in general, because of the fact that they're taller, that they can fall, you know, all that stuff. That's not what we're going to look at right now. We're going to look at specifically the ventilation angle of it. So as the hobby starts to evolve, we get more and more species in. So at first we get a lot of the starter species, a lot of rosies, the G. roseas, the G. porteri, Gramostola, Faunapelma, Brachypelma species. And then we start getting in some of the old world ones that need a little moisture. And then we start getting in the Goliath bird eaters. You start seeing those offered. And people realize these guys need moisture. They need quote unquote humidity. But what ended up happening was you would get your Goliath bird eater. We'll call it the Goliath bird, your T. blondie. You would drop it in a fish tank. You'd put in some dirt. You'd hear that you had to keep it moist. So you'd moisten the dirt and spray it down, and what would end up happening, with that top being open the way it was, the water would evaporate right out of it, and you'd have a dry tank. So people were going nuts trying to keep these tanks dry. So then what did we start doing? I believe it was the Tarantula Keeper's Guide that has a section about how to keep them, whatever, and it talks about restricting airflow, and it talks about taking... I could be wrong on this. I tried to find my Tarantula Keeper's Guide, and I couldn't find it right away, but I remember reading where you could take saran wrap and put it over the top of the enclosure to keep the humidity in the enclosure. So guess what you've just done there? A, yes, you've made sure that this tank will not dry out that quickly, but B, you've restricted all airflow. That is going to be a stuffy, nasty petri dish of a tank. And that was, I remember getting my first, you know, starting to really get into the hobby, getting my first moisture dependent species and reading the Tarantula Keeper's Guide and it talking about restricting the airflow. And I did all kinds of things to make sure that I never completely restricted it, but I did try to keep, when I used top open or enclosures that had ventilation on the top, I did try to restrict some of the airflow there because they evaporate so quickly. So what ends up happening is we start realizing A, fish tanks are not the be-all, end-all. We start using other things. We start making our own. We start finding plastic bins. Sterilite bins became very, very popular because of the fact that you could alter them and make them into a really good tarantula cage in a pinch. And we started putting the holes not so much on the top anymore, but around the sides. So what that does is two things. A, I can tell you for a fact, my son and I did a couple experiments way back in the day where we would take a bunch of substrate, mix it up, add water to it. We'd measure out the same quantity for two different enclosures. One of them would have side ventilation, cross ventilation, and one of them would have the open top with like a screen top, whatever. And then we'd measure how long, by basically weighing them, how long it would take them to dry out. The one with the top open always dried out much more quickly than the one with the side ventilation. So that's important when you're keeping these moisture-dependent species because you're still getting air going through the tank, although we'll get to that in a moment. Technically, you're still getting air going through the tank, cleaning things out, allowing that tank to breathe, so to speak. But you're not getting as much evaporation when it heats up in there on those hotter days or when the winter, when the heat goes on and it starts drying, you know, sucking the moisture out, it doesn't leave as quickly. So it makes it a little safer, a little easier to keep those moisture dependent species. So I think a lot of cross ventilation, that's where I stopped ventilating stuff on the top specifically because in my older house, when that heat kicked on during the wintertime, our house dried up terribly. Like, again, I've said before, it's the type of stuff where you take your fingernail and write your name in your skin. It's so dry. Very, very dry. The humidity in there was always in the low teens, sometimes in single digits if we had a streak of really cold days. And that proved to be hell on the moisture-dependent species. When I didn't have a lot of them, I would have in things when I first start off that were open enclosures, they were in critter keepers. We'll get to that in a minute. And they would evaporate so quickly that, yes, I've heard people say, well, it just means you need to add more water more often. Yes, that's true. But it's also a lot easier in those instances to miss one. I've heard stories of people that were like, oh my gosh, it got really hot here. The heat went on. It was getting dry. I was watering all my trash, giving water, and I noticed I missed this one, or it dried out and I didn't realize it. It just makes it a lot more stressful, I think, when you're keeping a lot of moisture-dependent species. With moisture-dependent species, the idea is you can moisten that thing down and you got some time before it completely evaporates, before you have to add more water. And I think when you have those top opening enclosures, you do a lot more dumping water in. It's just easier to have that side ventilation, keeping those things fresh, keeping the air cleaner, but not allowing it to evaporate as much. So I think a lot of it started to come from that. And then we started keeping, again, we got the avicularias, the Caribbean versicolors, where folks observe them in the wild and realize that, yes, it's super humid there, but they also are in the tops of trees where there's nice breezes keeping the airflow. And people started taking that aspect of it, going, all right, these guys are dying super easily. What are we missing here? We're missing that aspect of the airflow, the air going through the enclosures. So I think we move towards that with those species. And I do think that is, I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying do not do that. That's important. I do it with all my avicularias, make sure there's a lot more airflow, even more than I do with others. And then we started looking at it and going, wait a minute, if it's good for these spiders, it's good for all spiders. So then we made the push where the majority of keepers out there now, when they ventilate their enclosures, they try to make sure, and in case I didn't explain, cross ventilation, you have your ventilation holes on the sides of the enclosure, ideally four sides. Although a lot of people will put them on two sides because we want those clear viewing areas in the front or in the back, it became the, for lack of a better term, industry standard. And I do think, again, that it is the best way to ventilate them. I still don't have a lot of enclosures that vent on the top. I like the sides, but there's a couple things we have to think about. Now, one, I mentioned the Exoterras before. I didn't use Exoterra Nanos for quite some time for my arboreals because I was on the kick where everything had to have cross ventilation. And again, it's a good kick to be on. I want to make that very, very clear. But as I mentioned before, I saw more and more keepers that I respected that were raising these, that were using them and having zero issue with them. So I started bringing them back in. I had one that I believe I bought way back in the day that I ended up putting my young adult Avicularia vitata in, the first one I ever got. I had her in that. And then I had another one of the cubes, the 8x8x8s that Lazarus, my Brachypelma bami, was in for a little while. And then I took them completely out of circulation. They sat in my garage for probably 5 years. I started seeing other people using them, started seeing them pop up more often, started seeing breeders using them. And I'm like, wait a minute. Yes, we want good cross ventilation. Yes, when you look at these cages, there doesn't seem to be a lot of airflow on the sides, although there is airflow in a good area, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But all these people are using them, they're fine. So I started using more of them and found that they're working very well for me. They work great. Now, there's one thing that people forget is it's not amazing ventilation, but there is a vent along the bottom of the front doors on ExoTerra Nanos, on ExoTerra Minis, whatever ExoTerra you're getting. There's vents under there. And the idea of the ExoTerra is the airflow comes from the front and pushes up, and it comes out the top. So you get that airflow, not so much going straight through the aquarium, but through the bottom of that door and up through the top. So if you keep enough ventilation on the top, and again, a lot of us replace that mesh with drilled plexiglass. So unless you have a lot of holes, a lot of ventilation there, some of us use the Tinker Frames to replace the top. The idea is that air is going to be able to come through the front door, up the top, keeps the air from getting too stagnant in there. So they do work, and those are the ones I've had a couple people pop in on. Like, I thought these weren't good because they don't have the airflow. And you're like, you don't want to give people the wrong information, the wrong idea. Good, you do want as much airflow as you can get in any enclosure. Airflow is incredibly important. Top, sides, whatever you may do. I've had people come on and go, did I put too many holes in this? You can never put too many holes in it, as far as I'm concerned. If it's a fossorial species and you put a lot of ventilation in it, keep in mind you're going to be have to be a little more attentive to those moisture levels because it's going to tend to dry out much more quickly, but there's nothing wrong with having really good ventilation. However, there's a big thing that we tend to forget with all this, with any type of ventilation, especially cross ventilation. Putting the holes in is one thing. Having airflow is another, because to have airflow, you have to have an air current. And I think this is where a lot of us kind of stumble a bit, and I've been guilty of this myself. I'm sitting in a room right now that the airflow is still as can be. The windows are all shut. The door is at the end of the staircase. There is no breeze, no airflow in this room. So although the vast majority of my enclosures up here have cross ventilation, there's no airflow to push it through. And this is where a lot of folks that are really smart and really attentive to this type of stuff will put a small oscillating fan in the room just to keep the air moving. I do have an air conditioning unit in my room that I will sometimes kick on the fan just to kind of get some air from outside, get some airflow in the actual room. Without that air current, we're not really providing that cross ventilation. And I'll take it a step further. And this is not an indictment of people that don't have fans. I want to make that very clear because I don't currently have a fan running on up here, but it's just saying how we get caught on a concept, but we don't think it out all the way. Yes, cross ventilation is great as long as there's some airflow in that room. And I'm not saying we should have fans blowing directly on our tarantulas, but having something stirring up the air in the room to keep it moving. Airing out the room every once in a while. I have that air conditioning unit. One of the things I like to do is run a fan every once in a while. Just get some fresh air in here, get things moving. My other house was probably better for this. I did sometimes run a fan in it when it got really hot. But as I've told people before, it was basically that room was the passageway to go to the laundry room, to go to the garage. So there was constantly people walking in and out, shutting doors. So there was some airflow. The air was getting moved around in there quite a bit. This new room, not so much. And I think a lot of us do that, where we put them in places where they're not getting a lot of airflow. Now, if they're in, obviously, if they're in your living room or in a place where there's, you know, doors are open and closing, windows are open, sometimes you have a nice breeze coming through, obviously, there's no problem there. You've got your cross ventilation, you've got your air current. But I think a lot of us do things like we do closets, we have little rooms. That's something to think about. And another thing, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the enclosures we buy, especially if you buy the nice ones, the acrylic ones, a bunch of companies make them, you know, the 8x8 by 12 inch tall arboreal ones, there are ventilation holes usually on two sides, the right side and the left side as it's facing you. And as I mentioned earlier, there's usually not any ventilation on the front or the back. So that's good airflow. Obviously, if you put that on a shelf and it's on a shelf by itself, and you know, you've got some airflow in that room, you got a fan going, that's going to keep that air going through it. However, how many times have you seen pictures of people's tarantula collections where they have, and I'm guilty of this as well, because I'm looking at all of my arboreal enclosures, where you put them all on a shelf and they're all next to each other and all the holes line up with the holes of the one next to it. So basically you're blocking all the airflow just by how you have them set up. And I think a lot of us do that because you get these nice enclosures, you got this nice shelf, I can fit four of them per shelf, I put them all up. But when I put them up there, yeah, sure, the one on either end has an open airflow because the vents are pointing out, but there's a lot of airflow block just by the way they're set up. So that's something we also don't think about. That's like, all right, having the holes is one thing. How we situate them on a shelf, whether or not we actually have air flowing through the room, that's another thing entirely. I know back when I used to do a lot more of the Sterilite containers, I used to only put holes on the two sides and leave the front and back with no holes. And then I started adding like a few on the front, a few on the back. And now I'm looking around and the majority of mine have holes, all four sides, several rows of holes to keep that air going through it, no matter where they're situated on a shelf. But is that bad? No, obviously the idea is to keep the inside of those enclosures from getting stuffy. They need to breathe. And keeping that in mind, the more holes, the more ventilation you have, the easier it is going to be for those to breathe. But when we get to the top, the enclosures that offer ventilation on the top, as long as there's good ventilation on the top, those are still good enclosures to use. I know we want to, ideally, I would love cross ventilation on every single tank I use, and I don't use a lot of enclosures that don't offer cross ventilation, but the ones that I do are so open in the top that they are airing out. They are not becoming stuffy. I'm looking over at that Ceriopagopus species Valhalla crapella, not crap though, good enclosure. Enclosure with its opening, it has a lot of ventilation in the top. It's going to allow air, that cage, to breathe. I know because monitoring the moisture levels in that cage, that is a species that likes some moisture. When I pour my water in, I have to check it every once in a while because that line tends to go down. That line that marks the darker substrate, the moisture substrate from the drier stuff on top, tends to go down a little more quickly than it does with other cages. So that definitely works. Obviously, the ideal would be to have the ideal situation, the ideal setup, I think, would have enclosures that had plenty of ventilation around all sides. They were set and spaced on shelves so that there was airflow in between the individual tanks. There was some fans in the room just moving. Doesn't need, again, a fan on low. It shouldn't be blowing directly on anything. It shouldn't be creating this huge breeze. The idea is to keep the air in the room moving. That would be an ideal situation, but having top open ones that are great, well ventilated will work well. One thing I do want to bring up, and it's one that we don't talk about a lot, and back to the whole cross ventilation thing, slings. There's another issue. I try to avoid too much cross ventilation with slings. Again, you want them to be able to breathe, but for years I avoided keeping them in dram vials because I just thought they looked terrible. And again, cross ventilation. But I found that keeping them in the dram vials allows them to stay, it keeps those moisture levels up. It keeps the slings from drying out too much, too quickly, because that's the biggest issue for slings. I've heard more people lose slings, and I've done it in the past, where they've dried out and you didn't realize it, or they got them much too dry and you find the sling in a death curl. That's a big problem with slings. You want to have that environment. Remember, in the wild, they're going to be burrowing. They're going to be down under the dirt anyway, and they're not going to have all that airflow in their burrow anyway. So having them in something, as long as there's some holes on the top, you want to make sure that it can breathe. Again, it needs to breathe. But I've used some of the little sling enclosures that are out there, the really nice ones that have the, magnet tops and slide, and they are super ventilated, which sounds like a great thing. Ventilation is awesome. Don't get me wrong, but I have one that I had to use. I took the sling out of it because the ventilation was so good, it dried out super fast. And again, when you have only a handful of slings and you're being super careful and you're monitoring them constantly, not such a big deal. Back in the day when I only had a handful of slings, I was checking on them obsessively. Nothing was getting by me. Oh my God, this looks like it's drying out. More water. I was probably overdoing it, overcaring for them. When you have quite a few and you may not recognize that cage could dry out in 2 days' time, and that's what happened. One, I put a moist substrate in, put the spider in it. It got a little hot up here. Within 2 days, it had dried almost completely out. That was some scary stuff. So just, it's easier for me to know that they're in those dram vials because I know those dram vials tend to hold the liquid in there. There's not as much airflow, but they don't dry out as quickly. I think that's the bigger threat to the tarantulas at that point, as long as you're not dealing with avicularia species or Caribbean versicolor species. But a lot of my other slings, I want to make sure they stay moist. So just a heads up with that. That is something, and I have had other people approach me with mysterious sling deaths. We look at the enclosure and it's one that there was so much ventilation that you can tell the substrate dried out very quickly, or they might not have been as attentive as they should have. I can't completely blame it, but it's one of those ones you look at and it's like, all right, that enclosure right there, yes, a lot of airflow. And again, people, especially new keepers here, we need cross ventilation. They get slings like, we need cross ventilation, and they put slings in something that dries out super fast. That can be a danger unto itself. So just be aware of that. I've always said that, we have a lot of premium enclosures out there, and people obviously want, a lot of folks, especially, I shouldn't say especially newer folks, but a lot of newer folks in the hobby, they're spending money. They've only got a handful of spiders. They don't mind dropping a lot of money on sling enclosures, juvenile enclosures, where a lot of us have a lot of spiders, recognize they're not going to be in there all that long, so we'll wait to spend all the money until they are adult and showing off their adult colors. But they'll buy those enclosures. And I think this is one of those things that falls under that heading of just because it's more expensive doesn't mean that it's better. I have found when slings are concerned and when moisture-dependent species are concerned, sometimes you have to put the aesthetics aside and look for what's best for the spider. And that's why sometimes you get enclosed, you see things that, you know, the people will put Coelobrachia species in a 12 by 12 by 12 Exoterra cube, and they're trying to stack the substrate in, and the Coelobrachia is trying to dig, but there really isn't enough substrate. And it's not saying if people out there have smaller Coelobrachia species they work from, but full-grown Coelobrachia kind of needs more dirt than that. You see one of those deals where, yeah, your cage looks nice, but is that what's best for the spider? And I think with the sling enclosures, we got to be very careful that, yes, it may look really nice. It may have all that cross ventilation we really want, but we want to make sure that whatever sling we put in there, it doesn't dry out too quick. So just keep that in mind, a little warning with some of those things. So again, to encapsulate so that I'm not misunderstood, I don't want people going out saying, Tom Moran said the cross ventilation is useless. That's not what I'm saying. Cross ventilation, I still think, is the best way to ventilate spiders. I think it's important that we just all think about, again, that airflow, how airflow works, having some airflow in the room, maybe putting a fan in if you have a very stuffy room will help a great deal. Maybe spacing out the enclosures a little bit more on the shelf so that that air can get in between the cages so you can get air flowing through them. Because again, they're only ventilated on the sides and you've got them right next to each other, you're not getting that good airflow. Another thing is if it's ventilated in the top and you have a stackable one, that cuts down the airflow too. I bought some really nice stackable enclosures that unfortunately, as soon as you put them on top of them, each other, there's like a quarter of an inch of ventilation in between the two, and it doesn't really work as well as having that thing open. So long story short, yes, strive to have that cross ventilation. Try to have good airflow in whatever room you're keeping your tarantulas in. However, if you have to use a top opening one and it offers a lot of ventilation, it should work just fine, especially some of the fossorial ones. If I have a 12-inch tall enclosure and I put in, say, 7 inches of substrate, that spider's going to dig. It's going to, a lot of times they cover up those air holes anyway when they dig up the dirt. It's tough. It's tough finding enclosures that work well for these guys. So yes, you should always strive for it. But yes, a lot of us have had success raising spiders up in enclosures right through to adulthood that don't offer as much of the cross ventilation as we'd prefer. But again, I think sometimes part of the hobby is there's not a lot of stuff made directly for tarantulas. And even some of the stuff that's made out there doesn't fit our taste as far as the species we want to keep it or whatever it may be. I think it's just important to remember that at the end of the day, those cages need to breathe. So make sure there's enough ventilation to keep them becoming too stuffy. Because again, a super stuffy enclosure can be a death trap for a tarantula. So hopefully that spells it out a bit. Again, it's a tricky one because you know what's right, you know what's ideal, but it's difficult for us sometimes to get our whole collection situated in such a way that we're following those parameters. And I've struggled with it myself, which is why I spent years not using certain ones. Now I brought them back. Now I'm using the acrylic ones that I'm looking at that are all right next to each other on a shelf. So after we're done with this, I'm going to spread them out a little bit. It's a tough thing. And I am, it's funny, thinking about this more, I do have the fan in the window that does help keep the air flowing here. But I have been saying I need an oscillating fan up here just during those hot days to keep the air flowing. That's a good trick right away, honestly. A cheap trick, not the band, but a cheap trick to keep that air flowing, just buy a cheap oscillating fan, stick it on low, have it in a way that it's just blowing the air around. And again, open those windows every once in a while, get some stuff in there. That was one thing that I think the only thing that my old transfer room had over this one was the fact that there were so many people walking through it and the doors opening to the garage, the door to the kitchen was open all the time. We had windows open in there and the air would go through. I think this one up here, I need to be a little more cognizant of that. So hopefully they gave you some food for thought. Again, no perfect answer on it. I think we all do the best we can with them. We all strive for perfection when we keep our tarantulas, but sometimes you end up doing things that don't necessarily fall under the umbrella of what we would consider perfect tarantula keeping. And I think that's why there's just so many different ways to keep them. And I think that's why you just got to look at what's successful, what people are successful with, what works for them, and take solace in the fact that even if your setup isn't perfect, it could still be a good setup. So for the last topic we have today, we're going to be talking a bit about critter keepers. I don't know, again, I never know what's going on. I don't follow a lot of social media. I don't watch a lot of YouTube. I want to make that very clear. I've got just too much to do to kind of sit there and get caught up in all that stuff. But it seems like stuff goes on, and then all of a sudden I get bombarded with a bunch of people asking questions. The newest one's been Critter Keepers, and I've had quite a few people approach me over the last couple months talking about how Critter Keepers aren't appropriate for spiders. I had some come on one of my videos and go, I don't understand why you're using Critter Keepers. Those are terrible. And I was confused as to where this had come from, because I currently, looking around the room right now, I have 10 Critter Keepers still in use. I think at my high point, I had about 30 of them that I was using. And of the 10 I still have in use, three of them have scorpions in them. Three of them have adult arboreal tarantulas in them. I believe I have a couple pieces of Letharia in them. I have a Salmopeus cambergii in it. I believe one of my Selena Cosma crassipes in one. I have a C. darlingi in one. I have an H. baviana in one. I raised, I believe, 10 Harpactera species in those. I raised several OBTs in them. Lots of spiders over the years in them with no issue. And the thing I like about Critter Keepers is the bottoms are clear. The top's a lot of airflow, and talking about, again, good ventilation. If you don't do any altering of the ventilation at the top, and those things are about as open up top as an enclosure can be. A lot of airflow. So not necessarily ideal for moisture-dependent species, although I have used them for moisture-dependent species before. And what I've done is used tape, usually duct tape, to cover up the top portion of ventilation so it doesn't ventilate so much off the top. Now, keep in mind, they're angled. The sides, the tops of those, they have vents along the sides of the tops and on the top. And the ones on the sides are angled. So even if you cover some of the top ventilation up, there's still some top ventilation because of the angled vents on the side. But by covering up some of that, it has worked well for me for the moisture-dependent species. But again, like we were talking about with the slings, you got to be a little more diligent making sure they don't dry out, because on a really hot day or a day where the heat's running, they'll dry out much more quickly than they would with one that has cross-ventilation. I have cross-ventilated them before. That plastic, you can drill into it. I have several units in play right now that have holes drilled in the sides. So for the extra cross-ventilation, if you want some more in there, like if you're going to keep an avicularia species or something, you want it more towards the bottom so it's getting that good airflow. And speaking of that, I don't think we've mentioned this in the cross ventilation. Always good to, when you have an arboreal tank, to have some holes closer toward the bottom. Don't put them too far down. I've had a couple of nice cages that I bought that I think, honestly, they don't give me enough room to put the substrate in that I want to put in. That kind of annoys me. But you want some rows down the bottom too. And that's one of the reasons why I put some in my Critter Keepers. I've found they work great. You can usually buy them. I've bought a lot of them in bulk. I used to buy the extra large ones in bulk, like four at a time, and they end up being like $14 each, which is a pretty good deal for one that's, you know, again, they're crystal clear. They look nice. I have a bunch of the small size. I used to get them at Walmart. I'd order them online. They're probably about 9.5 inches by 5 inches by 7 inches. The smaller ones, love those for juvenile baboon species, heavy webbers. I've used them for C. cyneal pubescens. Again, as I mentioned, Harpactera. I've got a bunch of P. murinus I have to rehouse that are likely going into Critter Keepers. I have had great luck with them. Again, the only issues I have is they are so super vented that they're tough to keep the moisture dependent species in. And I've heard people complain that it's difficult to get the tops off, especially on the larger models, which can be kind of stressful when you're doing a rehousing and you can't quite get it off because the corners kind of pinch in. They can be a pain in the butt to get off. But besides that, they've always worked great for me. They're stackable. So if you have a large shelf and you stack them up because of that ring of ventilation around the tops, because the tops, again, they have the colored tops, which I think are kind of cute and pretty. You can stack them up. There's that ring of ventilation around the top that even if you're stacked, they're still getting cross ventilation airflow through the top of it. Just really versatile enclosures. So I'm not sure what the issue is. I have heard, I think somebody recently had a situation where one of their tarantulas broke a fang off in it. And I think some people jumped on and went, yeah, that's it. They can break fangs. Which, yes, obviously, when there's ventilation, if a tarantula finds a ventilation hole, it feels that airflow coming through. It feels the change in pressure because there's an opening there. They may try to chew to get through it. And that could obviously lead to a situation where a tarantula's fang could get caught or they could snap it off. Absolutely. However, they can do that with anything. They can do it with, they can chew through mesh vents. If you drill holes, I have seen ones, I have come up and seen ones with their fangs locked through the holes. It can happen with any enclosure, with any type of ventilation, whether it be little holes, whether it be slats. That's something that can be an issue. Now, it doesn't happen often. As I said, I've had many of them used over the years. Probably, I don't know. I would say at least I've raised at least 50 tarantulas and critter keepers at various stages, if not more. I'm guessing it's probably more, but I don't want to exaggerate. At least 50 without a single issue. Now, another issue that people have with them, unfortunately, is they make them in really tiny sizes, which look adorable and they look like they'd be great for slings. But unfortunately, the slats on the top, the ventilation slats, are the same size no matter what model you get. So they are not appropriate for slings in smaller juveniles. I want to make that very, very clear, because two or three times a year, I get an email from somebody who said, I got my new sling, I put it in this critter keeper so it had room to grow, and I can't find my sling. And you look at it, it was like a 3/4 inch sling, and it's a critter keeper. That thing is gone, unfortunately. They go right out of those slats, no problem. And really, I don't start anything in them until they're usually at least 2 inches or so, to be certain. So that's something to keep in mind. But besides that, they work great. They're cheap. They work great. They can look nice on a shelf. I'm not sure where it's coming from, where all the hate is coming from for the critter keepers, because I've had zero issue. Now, we did a podcast a while back and we talked about risk versus reward. And we talked about the fact that some of us, there's a lot of risks in the hobby, a lot of different risks that we have to kind of look at. All right, here are the two risks. For example, risk versus reward. I have an enclosure I want to use, but it doesn't offer good cross ventilation. It's got good top ventilation. Do I risk this? Do I think this will still be a good enclosure? Will the reward be it'll work out for my Cereopagopus species Valhalla? Or is it not worth the risk? Those are the types of little risks and rewards we weigh all the time. And we talked about with like crickets, and one of the things that came up was the Exoterra Nanos that a lot of folks will take and replace the wire mesh because they can flat out get caught in it. It can happen. I've seen it happen. But there are people out there that have been using them for years, never replaced the mesh, and never had an issue with it. So they're looking at us going, hey, it hasn't happened with me, so I don't understand what the problem is. So I think maybe with the critter keeper, if you know, someone has a spider that they kept in a critter keeper and it got its fang caught and broke it off or it escaped, that might be the type of thing that going, you know what, it's not worth it. If this can happen with this one, it can happen with another one. I don't want to go through this again. Therefore, I'm going to try something else. I can understand that. I can totally understand that. But for people to start talking about they're inappropriate or you should never be keeping it, I know I have seen situations, and I will point this out, where people don't use them appropriately. So for example, an extra large critter keeper can offer quite a bit of floor space. However, they're also very deep. I believe they're about 11 3/4 inches tall, maybe 12 inches tall. So if you only put a little terrestrial spider in there and you put like an inch of substrate in the bottom, that's a little too far for it to climb. It's going to climb up the top, not good enough. I usually like to fill them with several inches of substrate, which because, again, they taper as they get down to the bottom, gives them even more floor space up top. I have seen situations where people haven't set them up correctly in that respect. I've also seen, I use them for arboreals. And I've seen other people put arboreals in them. For example, somebody sent me one not that long ago where they had an extra large and they had like a little 3-inch juvenile Avicularia metallica morph 6 in it. And unfortunately, the setup was very Spartan, where there was a little piece of cork bark leaned against a corner. There was a water dish. There was a very tiny plant. And the poor spider, you could tell, was swimming in this enclosure, did not feel secure. Kind of what we were talking about earlier with skimping on the, you know, cork bark hides and on the foliage. It was just a bad situation. It did look like a terrible setup. So I do think, obviously, if you use one of these, you want to use it for something that is it's going to be appropriate for. Love it with the heavy Webbers. Love it for ones you want to set up semi-arboreally. Again, GBBs, they work great for, I think, because you can put enough substrate in there, some anchor points, and it allows them to web up through it. Now, would I keep a full adult GBB in it? I don't know. Probably not. I moved mine out because I got a nicer cage later on, but it could work. Some, again, P. Murinus, I'd probably want a little more room with that because that thing's going to get a little stuffy after a while when that thing hits adult size. You don't want a situation where, again, the way the tops are, when you rip the tops off, you're taking down about an inch and a half of your depth. Unfortunately, you don't want to be pulling all that webbing out and having an angry OBT. But with smaller specimens that web like that, again, I love it for the juveniles. Absolutely love them for the juveniles. I want to say 16 of the small ones that I use. Right now, again, only two of them that I'm using right now because I only have two that are appropriate for it, but I have a bunch of things I have to rehouse that I'll be breaking these out for. So again, and even, again, if you alter them a little bit, I don't think I like to leave the top completely wide open with moisture-dependent species because that whole thing just evaporates very, very quickly. But as long as you're diligent, you could use them for that because, again, the bases of them are nice and deep, would allow you to put a lot of substrate, moist substrate in there, packing down, would allow a fossorial to do what they need to do and burrow a smaller fossorial. So I do think they work well. I'm not sure why people are so down on. Were they made for spiders? No, they weren't made for spiders, but the majority of stuff out there isn't made for spiders. And I can tell you a lot of the stuff right now that people are making for spiders isn't necessarily appropriate. And I have issues with it. So I think they do work. I know they work. I've used them before without issue. If somebody had a problem with them and decides not to use them, I get that. If it's an aesthetics thing, if people don't like the fact that they're kind of a pain to open sometimes, the tops won't come off. If they just don't like the looks of them, if they don't, whatever it may be, I understand that. But to say they're not appropriate for spiders, I disagree completely. I think they can definitely be appropriate for the majority of species out there. And I, again, for the money, the bang for the buck, they look nice and they're pretty nice enclosures. So that's my take on the Critter Keepers. If somebody else out there knows something I don't, again, the drawbacks, tops, heavily ventilated, not good for slings, whatnot. If anybody else has something out there that they want to clue me in on, that's fine. I'll definitely listen to anything. And I'm always, again, always reevaluating what I'm doing. It's just that's a type of enclosure that I've used for a good many years, since way back in the day, with zero issues, and I found they're quite good. So the only reason I don't use as many now is because I got into some of the more higher-end ones, the Exoterras, some of the acrylic enclosures. So I've shied at some of the ones that originally would have gone into the Critter Keepers are now going into other ones. But again, I've used Pokies. I love them for Pokies. I love the fact that they're very open. When you take those tops off, they're very open in the top. I've explained before that for some of the faster arboreals, I like working from the top down. I don't like having a side door. So I like that aspect of them. I've used them for Pokies. You can fit a lot of stuff in there. Wait a minute. Turn around here for a second. Yes. Okay. My Pisolatheria regalis is actually in one with a plant, and it's been there for many years. And I love the setup for it. It's behind the cork bark. It's webbed a little burrow there. Sometimes I see it right on the face of the cork bark. Plant's still living. Hallelujah. Not sure what that plant was, but knock on wood, it's still alive. It's got the water dish. It's a nice little setup for it. So I don't get where that's coming from. Again, feel free to clue me in if somebody has some information. But that's all I've heard is that I do know there was a situation where one broke a fang. I do know people have had ones escape. That's about it. So I like them. If other people don't like them, I'm not going to argue the point. Everybody's got their own thing. That's why this hobby is so cool. There's so much to pick from. There's so many different ways to do things. But I don't think having somebody say I don't prefer them, or I don't like using them, or I don't like the look of them, is a lot different in my opinion than telling people they're not right for tarantulas or they're not good for tarantulas. That's just my two cents on. All right, so we made it through that. Ended up being a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. I had this in my head, and I'm like, we might have to break out a fourth topic because I don't know how long these are going to go on for, but we hit the hour mark, which is good. I know folks like the longer ones, especially folks with longer drives or bored at work. So there you go, another longer one. As for what's going on in my YouTube life, I always like to mention this because I know some folks like to go over there. I did go and finally put together the video featuring my top favorite old worlds. I already left a couple off the list that I'm upset about. I did tweak it a bit from the one I did as a podcast. I think I did it in 2018. I was shocked at how long ago it was. I had planned on doing a video shortly afterwards, never got around to it. But now that it's summer break, I have extra time to do the videos. It take a little while to edit, but I was pleased with it. I have 13 on it. I cheated with Pisolatheria same way I did with the podcast and kind of took them aside and said, here's my favorite Pokey for the time being, and then got into the other list. But that's up right now. And Billy and I rehouse, what are we? Harmonicon, I'm struggling with how to pronounce this one, but Billy got some great footage of the spider, even a point where it started to kind of skitter up the side of the enclosure right at the camera, and she didn't flinch. So we have some of that, and I did my, what the heck was the other one? Hogna Schmitzi, which is the Porta Santo wolf spider, but I believe it's Hogna Mediera now. They changed the name. Every time I go to do a video, I hop onto World Spider Catalog and I drop the name in because I want to see what region they're from, do a little, just read up on them, make sure I'm not putting any misinformation in there. And come to find out, in February of this year, they changed the classification of it, which was kind of cool. So I got to catch that. But we got that coming up, lots of stuff coming up. So that'll do it for this one. As always, you can find me on thomasbigspiders.com. You can find me on YouTube. If you stop over to YouTube to see the video, say hello. I love hearing when people come over the videos, leave comments, say like the podcast. That'll do it for this one, guys. As always, stay safe. We'll catch you all next time.